Hello, this is the Epsilon Theory Podcast. As always, we hope if you like this podcast that you will go onto the service you use to download it to like, share, and subscribe. I am Rusty Gwynn, and I am joined, as always, by my partner, Ben Hunt.
Hey, Rusty.
Hey, Ben. This is episode 7 of our podcast now, and we have a very, very particular topic in mind, but I will confess to you, I'm a little bit distracted. It's our first day in probably 5 months where the temperature has gotten above 50 degrees, and it's a shame to be here in the studio.
It really is, especially because you've got so much nice light here, and we can see the blue sky for a change.
It is nice. Well, I appreciate you coming and coming over, and you did, in fact, come over. You drove over, and given the topic of your recent note on inflation, I'm wondering, did you see any for sale signs in any homes between here and your house and the studio?
You know, I haven't started the whole process of doing the rigorous count every time I do the drive, but I didn't see many. There might be one, maybe two, but I didn't see many.
I'll tell you, we've gotten two broker or realtor led inquiries.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Saying, hey, you know, have you guys thought about?
Yeah.
Which, if for those of you who are not familiar with Lower Connecticut, is as far from the reality that we all lived in 2 years ago as is imaginable, which is in fact the point you made in one of your most recent notes.
Yeah, that's right. So we recently published a new note, called it the opposite of 2008, and it really hinges on, as I think a lot of the things that, well, I write about, and I think that all of us experience, is our own anecdotes or what we see in our own life. And there was a very important, experience for my life as an investor going back to 2008, actually going back to the end of 2007. And what that experience was is that I had to drive to the office, the hedge fund I was managing then, and it's about a 20-minute drive, and I was able to do it all through the back roads. And as you're saying, right, this is freaking Fairfield County, Connecticut, right? So it's essentially so linked to Wall Street and New York and the financial world. And every day I'd make that drive, and I'd be trying to, I'd count all the for sale signs on the drive. And, you know, I wasn't really doing it because I was really concerned about something. Maybe I'm on that OCD spectrum someplace, right, where I just need some sort of something to count, right, when I'm driving or exercising or really doing anything kind of tedious. I find the need just to count something, anything. Right? But anyway, so I started counting for sale signs. And, you know, on this drive, there were probably mid single digits to high single digit for sale signs at the end of 2007. And I really started noticing an uptick in that number of for sale signs in Q1 of 08, to the point where, you know, there were, you know, mid teens, probably about a doubling of the for sale signs. And by, call it May of that year, May of 08, and then, you know, of course, all through the summer and then into the dreadful fall that we all had, man, that number doubled and then went up still more from there. So as I recall, the high water mark was something like, you know, some high 30s number of for sale signs on that 20-minute drive to the office. And look, I mean, our hedge fund did really well in 08. It was kind of a career year for us. And one of the really big data points for me through all of that, we all need something to kind of plant our feet on, right? When we're doing things like making investments. And one of the things I was able to plant my feet on was the fact that in this community that was linked so inextricably to the financial world, everyone was trying to sell their house and there were no buyers.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because it makes me think a little bit of your your discussion and in many cases of cartoonified data.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that even that number in the years that would follow would become itself cartoonified by local regulations in many of these towns in Fairfield County. I know that in New Canaan, and I think it may be true in Greenwich as well.
You can put the for sale sign
up. You were actually not allowed to put up a for sale sign.
That's exactly
right.
And
so your metric became cartoonified. So
it absolutely did. Right. There was a response to try to control the presentation of for sale signs because it ain't good for property values, right? It really isn't. Well, It really was so important to me as these kind of groundings and non-cartoonified, non-abstracted data points, I think are really important for figuring out what's going on in the real world. And I think it's so important for all of us to have our eyes and ears open for what the world is telling us, right? Not what missionaries are telling us on CNBC, not what they're shaking their finger at us and telling us to think, but what are we seeing with our own eyes and hearing with our own ears in the world? Now, the reason I wrote this note was that I recently, it's years since I've made that trek, but about a week and a half ago, maybe it's 2 weeks now, I made that same drive. I said, all right, I'm going to count the for sale signs on that drive. And I counted them. The answer was zero. There were no homes for sale in this pretty long stretch of Weston and Westport, Connecticut.
Yeah. And for those who aren't familiar with the area, we are talking the New York metropolitan area, certainly the suburbs of New York. We are talking what I would describe as the true outer periphery of common commutable areas. Right?
Yeah, that's so, right. That's right. It's so the train from Westport to Grand Central is an hour.
Yeah.
Right. And that, so that's that kind of the,
that's the nearest point on your drive, and the furthest point from where you live would be closer to, I mean, if you took the running spur, it would be an hour and a half.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. 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 That's exactly right. So it you're exactly right. It's at the far reaches, let's call it, of what is commutable to go into New York. But you also have a lot of, I'll call it, related financial businesses, like mine was in Westport,
sure,
right, that are very much part of the financial system, for sure,
mm-hmm,
right? But what's also, I think, true about this area is that it's not a transient community, but there are always people coming in and out.
Yeah.
Always people coming in and out. And it was, I'd never seen this before. It was so striking to me, but there were zero for sale signs up. And then this is how the world works, right? That same day, somebody clued me into this article that had been written by at the New York Times. It was looking at all these different metro areas about, and the title was, you know, what happened to all the houses, right? Because in every metro area, I think certainly every major metro area in the country, the supply of homes has just fallen through the floor. Where in most major metro areas, the supply of homes for sale is half or fewer what it's been over the last several winters, right? It's seasonal. Housing supply is seasonal. Sure. But so making an apples to apples comparison, housing supply has just plummeted all across the country.
I'm sure your conclusion was just every American household spending twice as much time sitting at home, you know, flipping through Zillow. Is that
right? Exactly. Right. Yeah. But this is the second chart. So it's not just that the supply of homes has gone down dramatically, of course, leading to an increase in home prices.
Mm-hmm.
But that increase in home prices has been matched by rental prices not going up. Yeah. In most major metro areas, actually going down over the last
quarter. Well, that's good news. That means inflation's lower.
right. Well, and this was one of the points I made in the article, which is that if you look at how inflation is calculated, that CPI number that the government puts out every month, home prices don't get reflected in that at all. Not at all. It's treated as an asset. So even though, you know, your house is worth more, or you can borrow money on it, or it costs more to buy it and pay a mortgage, none of that goes into cost of living. So instead, they calculate what's called their rental equivalent, owner's rental equivalent. They say, well, if you're actually renting your house, of course you're not, what would you pay for it? And they make that evaluation based on, well, rental prices. So it's completely perverse and it's completely nuts. But what's going to happen in terms of the official numbers is that I think the contribution of housing to our inflation numbers, my best guess is that we're told that inflation is going down, even though we experience with our own eyes there are no homes for sale, and that the price of homes has gone up just crazily.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that there's a lack of people who remember that the most obvious evidence of inflation in the wild is shortages, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's right. And so I wrote this note because it jibes with the other things that I'm seeing and hearing in the real world, right? Where everyone I've spoken to, and it's nice because I'm in a position where I hear from lots of different people and places, right? Without exception, people who are in the real world are talking about how the prices of things, of the supplies, whatever that supply might be, right, has gone up dramatically, just crazy, and that their expectations are that the price are going to go up still, you know, crazily more. And none of that, I feel like, is getting reflected in what we're hearing from, you know, Powell at the Fed or other places. It's starting to appear now in markets, particularly in interest rates, which we've seen go up dramatically. And so I wanted to write this note to say, how are we going to put together a program, right, to figure this out? Because we haven't been as investors in an inflationary world for like 40 years. So what does that even mean? And obviously the world today is very different than the world 40 years ago in a lot of important ways. So not only what does it mean to be an investor in an inflationary world, but what does it mean to be an investor in this inflationary world?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you put it that way. Because I think it's first of all, it's a correct way, but it's also the way that I think we all tend to talk about the sort of idea of inflation. We use that term that says, or that phrase, you know, none of us that is investing today experienced
right
that environment, right? Right. I actually remember, you know, in my prior life, we had a mutual fund that where the portfolio manager was in fact someone who had invested when there was still an inflationary environment, and I'll tell you, it was it was a great marketing boon, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You know, that was sort of the thinking around, you know, what mattered. He was a muni bond PM, and it was this.
I'm old enough to remember.
And for people who were, you know, because at various points over the last 5-6 years, there's been what to do in a rising rate environment, mm-hmm. kind of, mm-hmm. you know, marketing pieces and all. And it tends to be framed around, wow, none of us remember how to invest in inflation. And I'll tell you, I think the problem is a lot bigger than that.
What do you mean?
So much of what we all do as investors, as allocators, as an industry is structured around conventions that themselves have emerged since the last inflationary environment. And if you think about the major organizing features of our markets, mm-hmm. over the last 40 years, what have been the big things that drive how money is allocated and invested? It's the rise of the fiduciary financial advisor, and the kind of the move away from just sort of pitching stocks.
Oh, right. None of that existed.
Or it was certainly far more limited, yeah. Right? It's the emergence of the 401k, which...
Right. That didn't exist.
And IRAs, right? I mean, this is all really since the very early 1980s, and then kind of in years... and law changes that followed that. But even more, I think, in my opinion, significantly in the institutional space, is that the industries, not to say that private equity didn't exist before, and certainly not to say that hedge funds didn't exist before. So please no one show me all those examples of, well, actually the first hedge fund. Which I get, right? But the endowment model of investing, which was then later adopted by every pension institution of other large asset pool, not only in the United States, but in the world, emerged during that period, right? And as we think about the progenitor, right, of endowment style investing, I mean, most people would say it's David Swensen.
Yeah, Yale. At Yale. Yeah.
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, David Swensen became CIO of Yale in 85, I think. And so none of the major conventions that I think about them, like the fiduciary financial advisor, the 401k, the IRA, the endowment model of investing, those are all post-inflationary environment innovations. And so the most fundamental infrastructure of investing, and by that what I mean is, what does it mean to be prudent in our industry? What does an investment policy statement look like? What are the components of a strategic asset allocation? How do we develop capital asset, you know, expectations and projections over periods? And how do we interact with consultants? All of that is built around the foundation of the world that's existed since the last time we had inflation.
The water in which we swim.
The water in which we swim is a non-inflationary and occasionally deflationary environment.
Yeah, you know, I really hadn't even thought about that, because I, you know, we use that analogy, and it's that old David Foster Wallace story.
Yeah.
Of, you know, the two young fish are swimming around, and the old fish comes by and says, "Hey boys, you know, how's the water?" And the two, they kind of nod, "Hey, yeah, whatever, Gramps." And then the two fish swim by, and one of them looks at the other and says, "What the hell is water?" Right? and we've used that story, that metaphor, on a couple of different notes. I hadn't thought about it in terms of the structure of, like I say, it's not just Wall Street, but how we think about money and investing. All of those kind of core ideas and principles. Well, of course you should have this endowment model where, you know, you're, and of course you should be, you know, getting advice from a fiduciary, right? And of course, these are all things that didn't really, they existed, but they weren't the water in which we swim 40 plus years ago.
No, and what I think we're likely to find, right? And we don't know when or how this environment actually starts to manifest. We're developing, as you say, the program or the framework for thinking about it. But what I will tell you is that Wall Street, and, you know, beyond Wall Street, also asset management more broadly, is not designed to deliver solutions to changes to the water in which we swim. They're designed, as we've been talking about, we talked about in our Business of Wall Street podcast, and, you know, the earlier podcast that we did on the Wall Street
and Bitcoin,
bets, and then the Bitcoin one as well. Yep. The business of Wall Street is to develop
products.
And so what I think is the upcoming conundrum and problem for investors and the industry is that the solution is a redeveloped understanding of the change in the water in which we swim, but the solution that's going to be provided is product. And so what you're going to see are increasingly rafts of the sort of usual suspect products that everyone kind of sort of thinks will work just fine in an inflationary environment, and that's sort of the solution. So you'll get a lot of the listed infrastructure or you know, public or listed kind of real assets type investments. You'll get the, you know, gold
floating floating rate
funds, right? Because that'll have in inflation sensitivity and rate sense, you know, the right kind of rate sensitivity that you want to have. And so you'll see those inflation sensitive baskets and product packages kind of put out there that are still structured around all of these conventions that we built up during these 40 years of non-inflation. And they won't be solutions to the fundamental problem.
Hmm. Well, and you mentioned this, and this is the purpose of this podcast, right? Which is not to say, okay, ta-da, here's the answer.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know. This all started with this realization that, look, in many ways, I think the great financial crisis came out of a falling out in demand for in the U.S. housing market.
Yeah.
And now we've got a falling out in supply in the U.S. housing market. And so I got to think, and I really do think, that it will have similarly enormous impact on markets, right? It's going to rhyme. It's not going to, you know, be the same. It's not going to be identical. And so I'm not saying that there's a crash coming. In fact, I think in general, what I'm describing is the opposite of 2008, not a gigantic deflationary shock, but an inflationary shock, a supply-driven inflationary shock. And that got me to thinking, well, you know, what are the other similarities, differences? I'm calling these tent poles, right? What are the big kind of organizing structural blocks of questions that we need to figure out answers to before we can figure out how to do better than just, oh, my broker tells me they've got a new, you know, inflation sensitive product that they want me to buy.
Yeah.
Right. Or something better than, well, inflation, I think gold. Yeah. Should I do that? Right. You know, we got to be better than that. And the first step, I think, is to identify, okay, what are the kind of big areas, you know, I'm calling them tent poles, that we need to get a handle on.
Yeah. So, right? So what's tent pole number one?
Okay. So thanks for the cues. Well, so we've got five of these.
Yeah.
And we'll introduce them, we'll talk briefly, and then we'll talk about what we want to do with all this.
Perfect.
Okay. The first tent pole for me is figuring out what happens to, what is the role in your portfolio, what's different and what's the same today about US treasuries.
Yeah.
Right? That core aspect of portfolio construction, you know, as it's been handed down from on high to us. And as I'm a true believer in, absolutely, you know, as a child of the last 40 years of the investing history, right? I mean, you got to have treasuries as this core aspect of your portfolio, right? Because that's what will do well when these deflationary shocks hit. And, you know, that's what you need when times are tough.
Not only will that do well, in a lot of the experience we've had for those deflationary shocks, it is the only thing
that would do well.
And with the exception in a couple of those cases of long-term trend following strategies, right? Mm-hmm. So some CTAs did well. Some funds that, you know, were long short in various asset classes did fine. But by did fine, I mean they didn't go down a lot. Right. The expectation of something that actually had portfolio protective characteristics, by which I mean during that kind of drawdown environment, they were negatively correlated with risky mm-hmm. assets. There was almost no other game in town than bonds. And in, you know, most cases, long bonds, most especially. So, yeah, it was an asset that worked well. In a lot of these environments, it was the asset that worked.
And when it's been working well, and in times of crisis, the only thing that works well over a 40-year period, well, then that becomes the cookbook, playbook. This is the standard. This is what you do. And so kind of my initial reaction is, well, of course, what you want to do is you want to then sell, or as I've talked about it, you know, treat them as a tactical investment rather than a core investment, which is a whole different way of thinking. Right. I think that's hard, if not impossible.
Well, especially it's made harder by the fact that the products that are going to be promoted increasingly are going to give lip service to this very idea. So mm-hmm. what you're very likely to see from people who are offering, you know, interest rate products, right, or, you know, any kind of managed bond portfolio, whether it's passive or otherwise, you're going to see a stark rise in the number that are offering what they call tactical portfolios.
Right.
Right. And so they're going to say, you know what, you should have more of your fixed income portfolio managed
in a tactical fund.
Tactically.
Yeah.
And in practice, what that means is, they're going to dial the duration between, 4 and 7 years. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's going to be a product that charges active management fees for very little expression.
Actually, active management. Yeah.
Yeah. Of a tactical exposure. Right. Because the water in which we swim is that the treasury bonds, U.S. treasury bonds, are the safe haven asset that provides negative correlation to stocks in drawdown environments and those deflationary shocks. And therefore, it deserves a large and largely static allocation within your investment policy that says, for your average pension, because they're allocating to other, we call them stable value assets,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in the 20 to 30% range for your, more vanilla retail portfolio, where the equity culture has pushed things kind of away mm-hmm. from 60-40 toward, 80-20, 90-10, basically, is that, your treasury bond is a portion of that 10-15%, but overall duration on average for a lot of these retail clients is probably in that, 15-20% range, but that's part of the investment policy statement, right?
Yep.
And so what's likely to happen is people are going to stick with that investment policy statement that says, yes, you still need this core holding of U.S. Treasury bonds at that level. And what we're going to do is we're going to replace a couple of the vanilla exposures to our, to UST or something like that with an actively managed tactical duration adjusting strategy offered to us by someone who came and sold that to us. I guarantee you that's going to be what 90% of institutions and advisors do.
And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about what do I think, not just about the way it'll be expressed in product, as you're saying, but do I actually think that relationship, right, of that's what bonds are for in your portfolio, does that still hold true? And a big part of me says, well, yeah, duh, right? I mean, as interest rates go up, right, the fixed income, whether it's bonds or whatever, you fixed rates, their value goes down. I mean, That's like the law of physics in as it applies to markets and to money.
Yeah.
So I say, okay, and so the products will come out, and that's not maybe a great thing, but it's kind of the only thing, and it's in the right direction. But then I got to thinking about, what if the water we're swimming in now, what if these kind of basic laws of money, where interest rates go up, the value of this goes down, what if that's is no longer really applicable today? Because what we're absolutely seeing over the last 12 years is that central banks will stop at nothing to maintain that smooth functioning, what I like to call a political utility aspect to capital markets. And if interest rates going up make that political utility untenable, right? Because either, if the interest rates go up, I'm talking about kind of, as you're saying, you said duration, longer term interest rates go up, and that makes mortgages more difficult, right? That makes the cost of for governments to support their own borrowing makes that a lot more expensive. If something is now impossible, then what we've seen is they'll stop at nothing to prevent the impossible from occurring.
Right.
Right. And we've already seen countries like Japan, I think Australia now is as well, engage in what's called yield curve control, which is going way beyond the setting the price of money, setting the interest rate for money at that very short end of duration, which is what really all central banks do, right? That's that the core ability of central banks is, all right, we're going to say, what is the interest rate of, you know, cash, you know, or essentially cash right now. That's to say, no. We want to determine what is the price of money for money you borrow for 10 years from now, for the next 10 years. And we already do a little bit of that. I mean, that's what quantitative easing is.
When operation twists.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So we're already doing some of this, right? Where there is this explicit effort made by all central banks, including ours, or certainly ours, to influence the price of money at different points in the future by managing their own balance sheet.
Right.
And you mentioned Operation Twist. That's the notion of, okay, well, we're going to buy more longer dated stuff. And so we're going to buy more, price goes up, yield goes down, interest rate goes down, rather than the short dated stuff. And then we can kind of control the average duration of our portfolio. Do we own short duration stuff or long duration stuff to have that sort of impact? Well, yield curve control goes so far as to say, well, all right, that kind of, it has that impact, but wouldn't it be better if we just said, no, the 10-year interest rate is now 1.5% period, and we'll buy as much or as little as needed to keep it at 1.5% forever and ever, amen. That's what Japan does, right? That's the whole notion of yield curve control. And so if the government is going to say, nope, your bonds can't go down in value, we're going to put a floor on the value of those bonds, then why would I want to sell them? Right? The answer is, I wouldn't. I wouldn't. And I'm trying to figure out, well, what does that mean? Because it's not like the government saying, nope, the price of the 10-year bond is X. And so it's got a 1.5% interest rate and nope, can't go higher than that. It's not like that's going to stop inflation in the real world, right? Or on the contrary.
Quite to the contrary.
On the contrary, that's going to juice it enormously. But we won't be able to use a selling down of our bonds, right, to address that inflation happening in the real world. This is what I mean by a tentpole, right? That there's this playbook that we know that, all right, you're going to inflationary period. Well, we need to reduce your bond portfolio. Well, that isn't going to be enough, let's call it, or it's not going to be particularly useful if your bond portfolio is going to be propped up in price.
Yeah, I mean, and whether this is driven by what you're talking about is yield curve control, or whether we're just sort of thinking about the broader treatment by central banks of risky asset markets as a political utility.
Yeah,
you're sort of making the argument if you do reduce your bond portfolio and do sort of say, hey, I expect this to stop behaving like an asset that is going to diversify my equity exposure. You're basically saying that at some point, the market and or the level of inflation is going to force the central bank's hand to fix remove it. The policy.
Right, to fix the, yeah.
So yeah, it doesn't work until it does, right?
Yeah. And it's, the implications of this, and I'm increasingly thinking that because the impact of interest rates going up to what we would have, 10 years ago or 15 years ago thought of just a normalized level, that even if interest rates are quote unquote going up for the right reasons, meaning that we've got actual growth happening and economic activity happening, when you look at the cost increase that makes in terms of a government being able to finance itself, when you look at the impact that has on so many of the engines of just economic political survival, I'm kind of the opinion that yield curve control in this sort of explicit way is just a question of when and not if.
Yeah, and I think the consequences of that policy also become a question of when, but not if. And I think there's another layer to it as well, which is investor behaviors that have accrued over 40 years. And even when, you know, let's say that, and again, I don't want to focus specifically on yield curve control. I know you're making that point. Even just the belief in a Fed put, right? A belief that central banks are operating, you know, for the purpose of making sure that, you know, equity markets don't decline too much. No matter which of those views you have, if and when it fails, you still have to develop a view as to why the ingrained behaviors of institutions that we've observed over the last 40 years would change. Because the playbook, which says, oh crap, my equity portfolio is tanking, I need to rotate into treasuries, that's not going to change for most institutions on a dime just because there's some kind of inflationary thing that seems to be happening here, right? I mean, for some, certainly it will, but I think in general, people are going to do what they always did, which is at the margin, they're going to buy what has been known as the safe asset. And so even though I'm sitting here kind of, you need to start thinking about how the water in which we swim is changing to one in which, you know, that treasury is not the diversifying asset. The process from here to there goes through, I think, a number of permutations. Including a change in our understanding of how long central banks can continue to pursue their current policy, and then how long institutional investors will continue to pursue their historical conventional responses to drawdowns in their equity portfolios.
Well, and that's tentpole number two, frankly, which is the central bank the narrative, the story that of central bank omnipotence. I don't mean omniscience. I don't mean they know everything, but I mean omnipotence, that all market outcomes can be determined by the Fed, and they've got your back. So they're going to put this put beneath equities. If tentpole kind of number one goes down this road we're talking about, then they're also putting a floor, right? They've also got your back in terms of the bonds. But what tools do they have then to address inflation in the real world? And my view is they ain't got them. They've built this Maginot line to protect against deflation. And they can do anything in terms of pricing of bonds and securities because they can just buy it. But that Maginot line against these deflationary shocks, price go down in either bonds or stocks, right? It doesn't do anything for what's happening in the real world in terms of real inflation happening again.
Well, I mean, if you have two objectives and they're both bond no go down and stock no go down, you're making the preference for US dollars and US as a safe haven market for all asset classes do a lot of work.
Yes.
Right. That is your Maginot line, right? Yeah. Is that the rest of the world is in the same, you know, crappy situation, just crappier. And it becomes sort of this argument that no, you've still got enough demand so that the sort of put option on bonds is not that much of a pressure, right? Which I think you could argue has been the right point of view to have for the last
15 years.
And has been profoundly right in the face of a lot of people sitting there saying, well, gosh, this sure is going to be inflationary, right?
Yeah.
And so the question, at least for me, and I think for allocators, kind of comes back to, okay, yeah, we recognize the rubber band is stretched, but I don't know how big this rubber band is. And I don't know how much, you know, that effective guarantee on both the role of bonds and stocks is in threat.
Yeah, and so, but this gets back to the original point, which is actually tentpole number three, which is behavioral change that comes out of COVID.
Okay.
Right, and behavioral change, both in kind of, I'll call it the obvious sense of, oh yeah, everybody's going to go out and do things, right? That there's a pent up demand. That's the, you know, famous, you know, you can't, you trip over yourself constantly, you know, when we, in our work, I've got a reading narrative with the description of pent up this and pent up that, right? But the other aspect of this, and this is what I was getting at with the housing supply, is, man, I you know, housing, there are no homes for sale because nobody's looking to move. And I don't know that that goes away. I don't think that goes away in a, I think, let me put it this way, the demand increases and the kind of reduced supply exists, even if COVID goes away tomorrow. But I'm increasingly thinking that in a, I'll call it a perma-COVID world, where it's a chronic problem.
That nobody wants to move?
I think that the desire to move out of the city exists. So rental, you know, rents continue, you know, multifamily rentals are continuing going to be, those prices will still be low. But I think the demand for, yeah, they want to move, but who wants to move, I'll say, out from their home to that, you know, condo in the city?
I see.
Right. Because that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
Is that there just are no homes for sale in Nashville, right? Or Austin. You know, you can get an apartment. You get an apartment easy, but you can't get that house.
And if it, you know, and that certainly is, I think, the common knowledge. I mean, there have been, you know, contrarians who continue to say this is all, you know, overwrought, and New York and Silicon Valley and San Francisco are going to be back. Just relax. You guys are all overreacting. You know, but, you know, we haven't even talked about whether remote work is part of one of those things that permits, you know, a more permanent transition toward places that don't have multifamily in any
right.
capacity.
I don't think that Weston, Connecticut is any longer the outer periphery for a job in Wall Street.
No.
Right? Because you don't have to commute into Wall Street. You don't have to go into Grand Central every day.
No, you've got meetings twice a week that you need to roll in for, and then it's remote. And, you know, even if that's not a truly capital P permanent thing, I don't know. I mean,
it's pretty attractive.
It certainly seems like there are permanent features of that within finance, at least. And you know, some of these things have been part of technology for a much longer period of time.
I think, and this is one of the big tentpoles we got to ask the question, right? We got to figure out the answer for. Are there very long lasting, deep behavioral changes in consumer and social behaviors that come out of COVID, whether it goes into a ta-da, COVID's cured world, or we go into a, I'll call it a perma COVID or chronic COVID world where you got to get your booster shot every year. Both those cases, I'm increasingly thinking, are inflationary worlds in terms of their impact on the U.S. housing market, which is still the biggest single asset class in the world.
Yeah, I have trouble parsing that because I, you know, a world in which COVID is, you know, an endemic and not, you know, not as bad as obviously the experience right. that we had over this last year, but where it changes things behaviorally. I still think of the backdrop of that, maybe outside of housing, as being generally deflationary.
I do too.
Yeah,
I do too. But when I look at what is happening in the U.S. housing market, and again, I'm playing this off my own experience in 08, where, man, that was the thing, right? And all of these business models, all, you know, is all, certainly in the financial, it was all geared around the U.S. housing market. And I don't think a lot has changed in that regard. And this plays out in so many different ways, right? So I remember 05, 06, 07, the enormous amounts of home equity withdrawals, cash money coming out, that then was a tailwind for, I mean, everything under the sun. Man, that's happening now too, right? So if you can't move, you don't want to move, it doesn't really impact your labor mobility if you're, you know, white collar or a, you know, a tech worker, right? Because you can start a new job because you don't have to move. You can just do it remotely from anywhere. But because there's no supply, you see what's happening to home prices, housing prices in your neighborhood. What do? You refinance.
Yeah.
You refinance. You take some money out and you build or you buy. And that's exactly what happened in 05, 06, and 07.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying, that for all these reasons, right, whether it's, so, you know, barring like a new variant surge where it becomes a emergency situation again, I'm increasingly thinking that a chronic COVID world that's manageable, I'm thinking it's inflationary.
That's interesting. So I'll say that I probably disagree, but what I agree on is that it is absolutely a tentpole and a fulcrum on which I think allocators who are determining when and how and how to quantify both the risks and magnitude of inflation need to be thinking about
it. I'll take that. All right. So we've got three tentpoles, right? Yeah. So it's, first is treasuries and bonds and what happens to them. The second is that, you know, the belief, the common knowledge, what everyone knows that everyone knows about central banks, which is that they determine market outcomes. And I think that comes under pressure.
And maybe not just equity market outcomes.
Right, exactly. Right. And the third tentpole we got to figure out is, well, what are the long-term consequences, behavioral changes that come out of a COVID scenario and COVID world?
Which, to be clear, since we're talking about behavioral changes, could long outlive COVID itself as we know it. So that this is why this fits into a water in which we swim discussion.
Right.
We're not overstating.
What's the water in which, you know, I'll call it, you know, survivors of the Great Depression. So we all have stories, you know, of grandparents, you know, never took on debt, right? Or you know, we're ultra cautious. My father was that way.
Well, I mean, I suspect you grew up in Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, my grandparents were from Texas, not to make us from two different generations, but we are from two different generations. So my grandfather and your my grandmother and your mother, I suspect, never threw away aluminum foil.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Never.
So I knew a world in which the idea of not throwing away aluminum foil was a thing. And I was born in 1982. So,
yeah. So these things, these events like COVID have these very long-term behavioral changes that when I'm thinking about it, I'm kind of thinking, you know what? I know COVID emergency was definitely deflationary, but I'm thinking that perma-COVID, chronic COVID, that can be inflationary. And that was kind of the aha moment for me about this note.
I think you're wrong, but I hold loosely to that view.
Fair enough. All right. So that's three tent poles of questions I really think we got to figure out.
Yep.
Right. Treasuries, central bank narrative, and then behavioral changes.
Right.
The fourth is also one that's happening right now. What are the fiscal policies that are happening today and its impact on markets and inflation?
And I think in a nod to the previous tent pole, behaviors and expectations for the common knowledge about what's
government going to do next time?
Yeah, what does government do sort of writ large?
Yeah. So there was this story as somebody was, it's a weird golf story, but so bear with me for a second. All right. Just a very brief
second. I will. When someone says it's a golf story,
I know. No. It's not my golf story.
Oh, that's even worse. Getting a third-hand golf story.
It's a Tiger Woods golf story.
Okay. That's better.
Right.
Okay.
And I think it was Tiger Woods. I think it's when he withdrew from a tournament.
Okay.
Right. It was the first time he withdrew from a tournament. And I remember talking to somebody and saying, okay, he did that. And the person said, okay, he's never going to, you know, match Nicklaus's record for majors. And somebody said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's not a big deal. So you withdrew from the tournament. He says, no. The first time you withdraw from a tournament, it makes it so much easier the next time you want to withdraw from a tournament and the next time you withdraw from a tournament. And that's where I think we are now in terms of government policies, fiscal policies, and their sense of how that has to be tied to taxation, how that has to be applied to deficit, how that has to be matched, or that it doesn't have to be. You know, once you make the snip, right, once you say, we're going to cut taxes and that's just going to add to the deficit. Yeah,
Yeah, that, yeah. There have been a great many Rubicons crossed at once.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. You're right. And I think that similarly, when I look at this most recent stimulus, and let's call it for what it is, it's a stimulus. It's $2 billion in stimulus, not rescue.
No.
Right? Stimulus. I'm thinking, yeah, inflation. I mean, how can it not?
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose I'm sort of delighted in a way to hear you describe it that way.
Estimus, yeah. You thought I'd take a good lefty soldier.
My lefty friend. Well, yeah. But, I mean, of course I agree. And, you know, the framing I would put it in is that it is a rescue for some, right? Because I think as we look at aggregates of household cash holdings and you know, credit utilization, on average, the American household's doing fine, right? The policies that have been passed, the legitimate, what I would say, rescue policies that were passed in 2020 appear to have stemmed the tide of the effects of coronavirus for most American households, which, other than I think the life and very real quality of life impediments that all of us experienced, and in many cases the dreadful physical and life consequences that came out of it, most American households came through it fine. But when I say most, there's two exceptions, one of which is the very truly poor and the working poor, who
unemployed working poor,
and yes. And especially in industries which were
yes
truly heavily affected, which could be, you know, on the retail side, on entertainment venue management, on you know, people who are working in, you know, non-educational capacities within schools that have been closed, yep, and people who are working in food service and you know, in bars and restaurants, and so a lot of those people I think have been influenced and impacted inordinately, and they're not really contributing as much to the aggregates, and so I think this is a rescue package for them, and I don't want to, you know, deny that, but it's for everyone else except those working poor, and I think truly small businesses.
Yeah.
Not small medium enterprise, but no. I'm talking fewer than 10 employee,
yep,
local, less than $1 million a year in revenue,
crushed,
kinds of businesses have been annihilated.
Right.
And I don't actually, what's funny is despite the size of the stimulus package, I actually don't think it does very much for them, but for otherwise it's just throwing money in hand.
No, Rusty, it's like every other thing we do in this country, it's trickle down support, right? It's trickle down, right?
You're trying to turn it back into a lefty comment here.
I kind of am. And because what I've always been in favor of from writing this stuff for a year now is a federal safe harbor for unemployment, right? If you don't feel safe at your job, you should be able to quit your freaking job, right, under COVID. And then there should be increased from the federal government unemployment support, like we did in the first CARES Act.
Right.
Right. But sending a stimulus check to, all right, Harper, I'm going to, you know, Harper's our producer, right? Pick on you, right? I mean, sending you a stimulus check was ridiculous. I know. She's
very
professing,
right now,
you know, shock here. but this is what I mean, right? It's not. Anyway, I do get wrapped up about this stuff.
But this is not going to be the last.
It's not the last $2 trillion.
We haven't even had Infrastructure Week, Ben. Or no, I'm sorry, no, Clean Energy Week. Sorry, we're not doing infrastructure anymore.
If it were Trump, it would be infrastructure, you know, or, you know, Make America Great Act.
This now
would
it's
be
green.
The green energy, the green Make America Green Act. We haven't gotten into
Green New Deal. I was trying to think. Yeah.
Student debt jubilee, right?
Oh, yeah,
that's clearly coming. Whatever taxes will come will be under the taxes as justice, right? The whole notion of taxes to pay for things, that's very quaint. It just doesn't exist anymore as an idea.
Well, and the one truth of American politics is that every debate is marginal, right? So if you propose to raise or lower taxes, the debate is never, well, what is the appropriate rate of taxes, and does that increase,
right,
or that reduction put it at a place that is more or less appropriate and fair than what it was before. It is, you are lowering taxes by this much for these people and, you know, raising it by this much for these people. Right. Is that marginal change unjust or just? That's the framing of every political debate, which means that now that there's been a $2 trillion stimulus bill, the prospect of debate over student loan
right
is not going to be, should we be forgiving, you know, hundreds of billion dollars in loans? It's going to be, now should we really be doing this for everyone, or maybe we should have a cutoff? It becomes a marginal discussion rather than a why are we really even talking about this at all discussion that it would have been even, you know, a few years ago.
And you and I can certainly argue on, you know, whether a specific policy, right, or the margin is good or bad. I think what we're both saying is it is. So, you know, universal basic income, of which this stimulus is part of, right? Or you know, in the broader heading of MMT, which we've written a lot about, taxation for justice, right? As which is clearly the way, and that's not just geared towards, you know, tax increases for as a question of justice, right? But was also with the, I like to call it the Tax Cut and Lull Jobs Act, right? Yep. Of 2000, which was an enormous tax cut or change in tax, but for a specific notion of equity.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's all the same thing. It just has different expressions depending on which side of the aisle you're on.
So figuring out, I mean, frankly, on this one, I'm not really sure that there's that much to figure out other than when this intersects with, when this tide that is very clearly rolling in intersects with the common knowledge on inflation.
Yeah. And where I think this really hits is not in current inflation statistics. Again, we've created this cartoon that in many respects makes it impossible for the current inflation statistics to go up rapidly and at a place where it forces government decision makers to say either, oh, we got to raise taxes, because that is what MMT says. Inflation is problematic, you raise taxes, right? That's the break. I don't think our metrics are constructed in a way that will ever require a decision maker, whether you're at the Fed or you're at, you know, in Congress, to say we either got to raise interest rates or we got to raise taxes.
Yeah.
What I think it'll always be, it's constructed in a way that the Fed can always say it's transitory, and if you're in Congress, you can always say, well, but we have to do it. It's a matter of justice, fairness, etc.
And anyway, it's worse than China. So
yeah, right.
Don't blame us.
Yeah, don't blame us, right? So, but where it can't be controlled is in the inflation expectations, which plays out in things like home prices, right? Which plays out in things like, well, you know, what am I going to charge for my supplies going on here? What am I going to charge for real assets? And that, ta-da, right, gets us to the fifth tent pole.
Yeah.
Which is, how do we think about real assets, which have always been kind of, again, part of the playbook. Oh, it's inflationary time. Well, you want real assets, right? Real cash flowing assets, pricing power, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And the flip side of that, which gets back to your point about how, you know, the water in which we swim as investors has changed so dramatically over the last 40 years in terms of the structures and the instruments. What happens to what I like to call these abstracted securities, the casino games that are markets today?
Yeah.
Because I there's a disconnect here, right? The all of the products, all of the what we invest in, they are these abstractions. They are, you know, I like to call them casino games. They are very far from a fractional ownership share in a real world company, making a real world thing based on real world assets with real world cash flows. I think, and this is kind of my big idea, right, is that we got to get closer to that as opposed to the abstracted securities. But what is the bridge in Wall Street to get to that?
Well, the bridge is reality at the corporate level.
Okay.
Right. Because what you end up finding, right? Because I think as we've understood now, at the end of the 40-year cycle, what's been clear is that what you wanted to have was a secular growth story.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you know that costs are easy enough to manage throughout your entire business,
and in any deflationary world, the costs are always going down. Your That's input right. costs are always going down, whether it's labor or whether it's materials or you know, a basic product that you're bringing in from China.
Yeah.
Right. Globalization plays into this too. It's all going down.
So if you've got that under control, then your second question is, okay, what are my costs of capital,
mm-hmm.
which are
zero today.
Zero. So okay. You've got that sorted out. And if you get your cost structure and your cost of capital sorted out, there's only one thing left that matters. It's how quickly can you grow your revenues?
Yeah.
And so what emerged was, because that was the reality of our world, what both management teams and, you know, people who are focused on, you know, creating transactions in Wall Street had to do is focus on creating narratives of secular growth
and profit and scale and scale,
yeah.
Right? Profitless revenue growth is fine because it's that revenue growth that's going to get you the multiple.
So, and I think what people tend to do whenever they look at, well, what would happen in an inflationary environment is they start thinking about things in this almost sort of pseudo empirical way where they look at, well, here's what equities did in the months where inflation sort of spiked up. It's like, no. The narrative of secular growth as the objective of a C-suite or of people who are allocating capital goes away whenever those two other variables come into question.
Right.
And so at some point, the thing that changes it is the reality that forces the corporate boardrooms to realize, okay, you know, we are not getting the stock price response that we used to get from selling a narrative of secular growth because, well, in an inflationary environment, everybody's got some top line growth.
Yeah.
So our 20% CAGR no longer looks as, you know, remarkable and special as it did, you know, 5 years ago. And so now all of a sudden there are these other very real considerations that are actually hitting earnings and, you know, and the bottom line. So there is a reality that comes, and with that reality will come, I think, a change in the water in which we swim of how all of the assets that are wrapped into this abstraction that is a corporation, and then a further abstraction, which is that corporation's stock.
Yep.
And then that further abstraction of the stock into what is that stock's narrative.
Yep.
That collection of assets and the way in which these businesses are operated will begin to transition. The assets which looked really attractive in a secular growth environment by the good management teams will start to be shed in favor of the assets which start to look better for an inflationary environment. And so there's a period of time over which the corporations themselves that are listed on exchanges in the United States and in other countries around the world start to look different if we are in a sustained inflationary environment. But not to use, you know, the Fed's language, you know, on my own, but I mean, there is a transitory period in which that hasn't happened yet.
Yep.
Right. In which that reality has not manifested itself, and in which corporate America has not responded, as I think this is the beauty of markets, as I think they will, and as I know that they will. And in that interim period, getting back to this question of real assets and abstracted securities, there's a real problem of how the investor actually accesses good exposure.
But see, this is the thing, and this is where we're going to finish up this podcast, because this is a real opportunity.
Yeah.
Right. The opportunity then is for, I'll call it active management, but shoot, let's call it us, right? Let's call it the Epsilon Theory pack, right? The opportunity is to figure out, well, if top line growth is no longer going to look special in a corporate strategy in terms of being rewarded with a better stock price, what will look special? What has a winning narrative and works in an inflationary environment when your input prices are going up, not go down, when your cost of capital is going up, not stuck at zero, right? What what is it that looks special? And let's start looking for companies that have that.
And what is accessible to investors who can't just go pick up
right.
farmland acreage
right.
or
exactly.
an operating company or an intellectual property asset other than, you know, a fractional share of a
of
Kobe
Microsoft.
Bryant dunking
yeah.
video.
right.
Or, you yeah. know, because I think if the investable universe for a retail investor to respond to this problem until corporate America makes equities the answer again.
And,
right?
and to be clear, they you and I are retail investors.
We
right?
are.
Right, right. But yeah. if it was available to us.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most private equity funds and hedge funds, you know, I would not meet their minimums.
No.
Right. And so we're part of this group too. And if the answer is, well, gold, silver, Bitcoin, well, I'm not saying those aren't answers.
I know.
But if
right?
the breadth of your expression of this idea is limited to three things, which are intensely driven by the behavioral responses of huge swaths of investors whose behaviors are unpredictable, I don't think that's enough breadth to
right.
really express this.
Right.
And
it's very unsatisfying.
and buying a REITs portfolio and an infrastructure portfolio in the listed space.
A floating bond or a floating rate bond or a loan portfolio, right?
That ain't it, Chief.
That ain't either, right? But well, I think yeah. there's a real opportunity yeah. here, Rusty. I really do. And so that's what we're trying to build on our website, right? With what we call the ET Forum.
Yeah.
Where we've got now, you know, 700, you know, actively participating PAC members trying to figure this stuff out. And, you know, it's what I'd recommend or hope everyone on the listening to the podcast comes and checks out EpsilonTheory.com.
Absolutely. And what we also hope everyone listening to the podcast does is go onto the service that you use to download this. And like, share, and subscribe. Give us a thought. Also, reach out to us directly. You know, send me Ben an email. We're always happy to talk. You know, Ben's happy to talk on Twitter. Me less so.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode. And we'll see you in a week or two.